Hey, this is Nick Gelso, co-owner and founder of CLNS Radio. Today's podcast is brought to you by Lynda.com. Lynda.com is the home of expert video tutorials. Because you're such a loyal listener of CLNS Radio, and it's 2015, you want to kick the new year off in style, claim your free trial today from CLNS by going to Lynda.com/CLNS. That's LYNDA.com/CLNS. Now on to your regularly scheduled program.
Welcome to the Boston Celtics postgame show on CLNSradio.com.
Off the turnover, Rondo reverse, banks it in.
Fans, this is your destination for interactive Celtics coverage all season long.
Kelly still has time, takes it.
So what are you waiting for? We want to hear from you. Dial in at 347-215-7771.
Green out of the corner. Got another one.
Now let's get it started.
Welcome to the Celtics postgame show. I'm your host, Bobby Kravitsky. Alongside me tonight is Calvin Chamberlain. We've got the one and only Matt Rury on social media, so be sure to get all your questions and comments about tonight's victory to him. And tonight's show is brought to you by Lynda.com. New skills, improve skills. Now learn technology, creative, and business skills that you can use today. So be sure to go over and check out Lynda.com. And if you want to get your opinions heard on the show tonight, feel free to call in to 347-215-7771. Again, that's 347-215-7771. The Celtics handle business tonight in Charlotte. Calvin, what were your thoughts overall on this game?
Excuse me. Now I'm on the air now. Okay, I had a lot of issues with League Pass tonight, so I was in and out of it for some stretches, but I definitely saw the crux of when the Celtics made their run in the second and third quarters, and a lot of that had to do with their defense. I was really impressed with the way that they managed to push Al Jefferson out of the low block position that he favors. Tyler Zeller in particular was very impressive with that in Bass. I think that they, managed to seal off the rim pretty well. I think that Jonas Jerebko played really good defense when he was in there. Wallace played good defense for stretches. Jay Crowder, they forced a lot of steals. They did not give a lot of points up in the paint. They essentially, Charlotte is not a traditional fast break team, but, Kemba Walker really didn't get a lot of looks. He's their one guy who likes to get out and run. They didn't really get out and run the entire game. They had 9 fast break points for the entire game. So I think tonight it all started with defense.
Yeah, and the backcourt of Avery Bradley and Marcus Smart did a terrific job against Kemba Walker, making life difficult for him all night. Bradley, offensively, 30 points, 12 of 23 from the field. He shot just under 43% from beyond the arc, even chipped in 8 rebounds. Calvin, he had himself a night.
Yeah, it was good to see him aggressive early. I think that, I don't know if Isaiah Thomas is fully recovered from, his back issues, but I think that we kind of saw Avery Bradley take on that Isaiah Thomas role tonight where, he got the ball in his hands, and when he did, he was going to shoot. I mean, he only had 2 assists. He wasn't looking to pass. He was looking to score, and tonight, he did that effectively.
Now, part of that, like you said, is probably a result of Isaiah Thomas not being 100%, but would you like to see Bradley play this aggressively, get this type of volume of shots moving forward, or was this more circumstantial?
I think it was more circumstantial. Avery Bradley is primarily an off-ball player, and I think, even tonight, I think part of it is that the Celtics run a lot of pick and roll, and Charlotte sort of blows up the pick and roll, and I think that they were, they were finding Avery Bradley off their screens on the perimeter, and that's sort of I feel like his offense always exists sort of on an island separate from what's going on with the other guys on the team. Like, they always run plays for him to get him shot, but those seem to be like specific Avery Bradley designed sets rather than, getting Avery Bradley the ball to get somebody else a shot. So I think that in his case, it all depends on how that's being defended, but oftentimes in that scenario, his shots are sort of, it's sort of almost a separate offense in what's going on, you know, with a guy like Thomas or somebody else. I actually thought, despite the fact that Thomas only went 3 of 9, I thought that he had a very effective game, cutting to the rim and finding a lot of guys open on the perimeter. He ended up with 7 assists. He was a lot more unselfish than he usually is, and I thought he was really effective tonight, despite the fact that his shot wasn't falling.
And that was encouraging to see, because normally Thomas is known for his scoring, like you alluded to. However, he is a playmaker. He does have that ability within himself. Usually his assists aren't 7. They're more around that 4 to 5 mark, but he was able to create for others more so, knowing that his shot wasn't falling tonight.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think that. I think that he, you know, still managed to penetrate, which is what he needs to do. You know, the thing, one of the things this team lacks sometimes is guys who dribble penetrate and get to the rim. And, you know, that's what he did. I think a lot of Kelly Olynyk's offense came from Isaiah Thomas tonight. Several shots, the way he went to the rim. And he found Gerald Wallace for a dunk, which is, you know, something that I didn't think I'd see anytime soon. And
not just any dunk, an alley-oop. Gerald Wallace climbed up over someone to get that thing.
Yeah, a ferocious dunk over somebody's back. I was surprised by how spry he looked tonight. I was impressed with him. I think a lot of that had to do with Thomas's penetration.
Now, it's
Evan Turner, to a degree as well.
Yeah, Evan Turner also had an effective game for the Celtics and has really been effective lately out of that small forward position. Now, you brought up just a second ago the name Kelly Olynyk. I know you, for the most part, League Pass only allowed you to see the second and third quarters, but I got to be honest, in the second half, I was very disappointed. Usually, an inconsistent Olynyk describes how he plays from one game to the next, where he'll be aggressive one night and put up big numbers, and the next night will be passive, and you'll hardly even notice his presence out there. Tonight, it was, in the first half, especially that second quarter, he was scoring inside. He was taking shots from deep. It was very nice to see. And then all of a sudden in the second half, it didn't carry over, and he was much more of his timid version of himself.
No, I managed to see it off and on, and I will say you're right. He wasn't aggressive offensively in the second half from what I saw, but I did think there were a couple possessions there in the fourth quarter. There was a possession in the fourth quarter where he was really shadowing Al Jefferson in the post, and he used his long arms to deny Jefferson the ball when they tried to do an entry pass to him, and that led to Marcus Smart getting a turnover. So I think that he was – you normally don't see him playing that sort of effective post defense. So you're right, offensively he seemed to fade, but – on the other hand, he did seem to do a better job than you'd expect on a guy like Al Jefferson.
He was a part of holding Big Al to just 12 points on the night, which was impressive for a Celtics team that doesn't always fare well against big men who are able to score so effectively from the blocks as Al Jefferson is. But like you said, did a good job pushing him out, catching it a bit past where he wanted to, sometimes even further than that, as a matter of fact. Now, going back to the backcourt, Marcus Smart, 14 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 steals, and Calvin, an emphatic block on Kemba Walker. What did you see from the rookie point guard tonight?
Yeah, you mentioned that block. It was fantastic. He played a lot of in-your-face defense. The second half, I thought their perimeter defense sort of slipped a little bit, or rather in that fourth quarter when they made their run, it was largely Kemba Walker and Mo Williams. So, Mo Williams obviously didn't have a good game overall. Neither did Kemba. I thought in the fourth quarter, I don't want to say they relaxed because I think they were still swarming, but maybe they pressed a little bit too much, I thought, and it led to some fouls that maybe they shouldn't have been called for, and that allowed Charlotte to stop the clock and get back into that game.
Now the Celtics, they made their run starting really in the second quarter. Of course, they came out of the gates with a great start. It was about 11-2. From the get-go, and then they finished the first only up by 2 points before making a huge run midway through the second quarter to extend the lead into double digits going into the half. Did you think that this game was more a product of Charlotte not really coming to play until the fourth quarter, until they got into desperation mode late, or did you think this was that both teams came out ready to play and the Celtics just just wanted it more and were just flat out playing better.
Yeah, you know, Charlotte's not a great offensive team. They make their bones with their defense, and I didn't think that they were at their peak defensively. They're sort of a weird team in that, like, you know, they don't have a lot of great individual defenders, but it's just a lot to do with scheme and a lot to do with, you know, Biombo. They don't have MKG, so you can factor into, you know, maybe that's why if you're starting, if you subtract him and you replace him with, you know, your Jeff Taylors and your Marvin Williams, well, you're not going to really protect the rim with Al Jefferson. Jason McNeil, you know, I thought did an adequate job as a substitute, but I think that Charlotte, yeah, they sort of make their bones on defense, in my opinion, and Kemba Walker's heroics. And I think, one, he had a tough time defensively with the Celtics perimeter defenders who, you know, are a bad matchup for him because his game, for example, is not based on strength, and that's something he can be manhandled a little bit by Marcus Smart. And a guy like Bradley, who can sort of be bulldozed when it comes to defending a stronger guy, he didn't have that issue with Walker either. So I thought they did a good job containing him and Mo Williams. And it's just a bad matchup, I think, for them, particularly without MKG out there.
And the Celtics did a terrific job of attacking that Hornets defense, which, like you said, was weakened by the absence of Kidd Gilchrist, and so much so that they forced Charlotte to switch up and go zone. And even then, Calvin, I was impressed with the Celtics' ability to get into the paint, to attack that zone defense, and a big part of that was Kelly Olynyk.
Yeah, definitely Olynyk was, like you said, more aggressive early on in the game. There were a couple of nice moves early on by Zeller, although with him I was more impressed with his defensive end. I thought they usually had a guy near the rim, like Wallace and Jay Crowder, both, you know, got a couple of offensive rebounds, got inside against a team that I guess you could say is bigger than them, particularly, you know, they played a lot of Maxeal with Jefferson and a lot of, you know, Jefferson and Biombo, or Maxeal and Biombo. So they played a lot of traditional two big sets that you would think would give them the advantage on the boards, but they really didn't rebound that well. I think the Celtics did a good job boxing out. Guys like Jay Crowder, like I said, undersized guys were managing to get boards that you wouldn't expect them to get. Al Jefferson, you know, not only not that impressive, in my opinion, offensively, but a guy who's normally a piece on the board ended up with 5 total. So you really have to respect what they did to clean up the glass tonight.
Yeah, the Celtics not only out-rebounded Charlotte in the first half, but also had more points in the paint by a margin of 24-16. And a huge part of all this success was the bench. Boston's second unit outscored Charlotte's 22-16 in the first half and was a significant factor in being able to get an important road victory tonight.
Definitely. And another guy who I thought really played well defensively, and he's sort of a guy who he seemed like he was guarding, you know, smaller guys and bigger guys without really much of a transition, was Jarepko. I don't remember him being that good of a defensive player in Detroit, but tonight his help defense, you know, helping to double team Jefferson and then get back out to a shooter was phenomenal. Or guys cutting down the lane, he's swiping at the ball. I was really impressed by his energy. I know he only played a quarter, but you know, and he didn't really fill up the stat sheet, but from what I saw of him, I really liked his help defense tonight.
Yeah, Calvin, I agree with you there. And my mental notes on him from when he was in Detroit and the Celtics had just acquired him were two things. One, that, like you said, he can stretch the floor and is a good 3-point shooter. And the other is the energy. He's a guy who always brings it. He's similar to Jay Crowder in that sense, that you know what you're going to get in terms of effort level from him. He's a high motor player who's willing to dive on the floor for loose balls and whatnot. And I think that's really what's allowing him. He's not the most athletic player, though he is versatile for his size, but that effort, that motor, plus the fact that he's getting a genuine opportunity here, which he didn't really have in Detroit, especially under Van Gundy this season, is allowing him to be more effective on the defensive side of the ball as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think, you know, part of it is sometimes a change of scenery just helps. A guy sort of thinks of himself as a specialist, or, you know, comes down to one role and on one team, and on another team you really have an opportunity to redefine yourself. And I think right now, you know, I wouldn't get carried away and say that, you know, he's fantastic, but I think that he's played better defensively than I've seen him, and he sort of has played more of a jack-of-all-trades role, you know, and you could say the same thing for Datome. When he manages to get in the game, he's been impressive as well.
Yeah, both of them have been important cogs since coming over in the Tayshaun Prince trade. Just a reminder that you are listening to the Celtics post-game show, and if you want to call in, make your presence felt on the program, do so by dialing 347-215-7771. Again, that's 347-215-7771. Calvin, I'm curious to get your assessment of this. The Celtics had 7 steals. They kept the turnovers to single digits. They had 14 offensive rebounds. There wasn't an area in my mind that they were great in, but they did a lot well. And to me, that's why they won the game.
Definitely. I mean, you know, the numbers are even better than they look, because it was essentially a blowout and they took their foot off the gas and Charlotte came back short. And then what happened is, you know, they put their foot back on the gas the last couple minutes of the game after Charlotte had cut it to 6. So you can say, you know, that the numbers are probably even a little bit better. I thought they really protected the ball well, other than Smart, you know, who continues to be a little bit loose with the ball. The thing about Smart is that he's just not a ball handler yet at this point in his career. And, you know, Avery Bradley wasn't a ball handler, and he's still not a great ball handler, but he certainly made strides in that area. I think Smart, same thing can happen to him, but I just wouldn't look for him to play that point guard role, especially when they have, you know, Turner kind of plays the point guard in Isaiah Thomas, obviously, even though he's more of a shoot-first point guard, but that's what you have. But, yeah, other than that, everybody, I thought, protected the ball really well. Like you said, 7 steals, you know, to give credit back to Smart, he got 3 steals himself, so that was a wash in that department. Again, you know, only 1 block, but they don't have shot blockers. They just really played good defense. Sound principles all the way around. You're right. They, you know, hit 73% of their free throws, which is for them lately is you know, is about as good as you can expect. They hit half their shots, and you know, they hit about 35% of their threes, which is not fantastic, but for the team that we're talking about, it's pretty good as well.
They also got to the line 23 times tonight in order to shoot, like you said, 73, just under 74% from the charity stripe, which was impressive for them, because this is a team, Calvin, that usually in losses, one of the factors that you can point to, especially where it's a game where the offense hits a dry spell, is they didn't get to the free throw line enough. And that's usually an area that Isaiah Thomas helps elevate for this team. But like you said, he's not 100% yet, still coming back from injury. So they didn't get that boost in terms of getting the foul line from him. Yet pretty impressive. They still get to the line 23 times overall tonight.
Definitely. And it was a balanced attack. Like you said, Thomas, you know, not himself, not really. He's a guy who draws a lot of contact. Nobody else on the team really draws that much contact. Part of it was, you know, I thought Charlotte was playing a little rough. Biombo in particular and Maxiel, you know, some of their big guys were a little rough when Boston cut to the basket and allowed, you know, they grabbed Bass a couple of times when he had potential looks at the basket. So I think that's really where a portion of those foul shots come. The Celtics aren't really a team that draws that many fouls based on their style of play, but, you know, Charlotte was not looking to let them get any buckets inside tonight, and I think the trips to the line were the consequence of that.
Luckily, the Celtics were able to convert those. They also did a terrific job of protecting the three-point line, held the Hornets to less than 27% shooting from beyond the arc. What did you notice in terms of the Celtics' perimeter defense tonight and why it was so effective?
I think that Kemba Walker is sort of a slight one. I think a big part of why their defense was effective is they were Charlotte's inability to rebound, and the fact that Charlotte is a team that gets back quickly. I think that Walker is most effective in a full court scenario, and they just didn't have any fast break opportunities. They only scored 9 fast break points for the entire game. They struggled in getting out in the full court, and I think that's where Walker could take advantage of his speed against that team. But otherwise in half court scenarios, he was hounded a lot by guys like Smart and Avery Bradley, guys who were bigger than him, guys who were stronger than him. And so I think we saw the concept. And the same thing for Mo Williams. He's a small, you know, he's a good shooter, but for him to be an effective shooter, he's got to have somebody else, you know, creating him open shots or get to the basket, which he wasn't doing either. So I think it was just a matter of a bad size matchup, and, you know, he couldn't take advantage of his matchup because they weren't, you know, getting those fast break opportunities because they weren't getting any rebound.
Does that surprise you that a player like Kemba Walker, who's so good with the ball and he is slight of frame, that he's not, you know, he's not more effective? Maybe that's the wrong word, but just the fact that he's not, you know, at his best when in transition, when there's more space to operate with, and, you know, there's more space there for him to not only operate with, but to pull up for three-pointers with. Does that surprise you that he's not, you know, more, you know, that he is more effective, I guess I'm saying here, from operating out of half-court sets than he is in transition where there's more space and you think it'd be easier for him to get his shot off?
Yeah, it's interesting because he sort of has that Isaiah. He does have that Isaiah Thomas quality of somehow being more effective in fourth quarters, and when there's really no explanation for it. You know, Kemba Walker's not really had a very good year at all. He's only shooting, almost 39%. Not really had the year that he had last year. He seemed to be on the verge of a breakout. I don't know what it is, but his offense has regressed. I think a lot of it is his shot selection. But yeah, I don't even think he's that effective, you know, early in games, period. I think that there's something about him that when he gets in that hero ball mode, that he's one of the guys who's strangely more effective than he is when he's trying to be a traditional point guard.
Considering that the salary cap is expected to spike soon, with the television contract set to kick in, what type of money would you pay Kemba Walker?
That's a difficult question because here's the thing. I think that you could arguably justify paying him, you know, $18 million because of, like you said, the potential rise of the cap. But the counter to that is once you pay him that kind of money, then Kemba Walker has to be your starting point guard for the life of the contract. And I think you also have to factor in simply the number of point guards in the NBA and the ability to acquire another point guard versus, you know, where Kemba Walker ranks on a list of point guards in the league. If you're paying, regardless of how good he is, you know, as a scorer compared to, you know, and the average shooting guard, or even if he's, you know, obviously the second best player on the team. If the second best player on the team is the 19th best point guard, but, you know, Gerald Henderson is the 11th best shooting guard, even though he's nowhere near as good as Kemba Walker, can you really justify paying Kemba Walker that much more than you would pay Henderson? Not that I'd pay Henderson either, but you get what I'm saying in hypothetical terms. Like, is it really worth it paying a guy that far down the point guard list big money when you can, you know, not do that and really find another guy for significantly less money? I don't know. It's a tough question, but I think I would lean towards, you know, not giving him more than $15 million.
Yeah, and I like your logic there. Of course, it is important to remember that Michael Jordan is the one signing the checks, and I know he's got a GM and others in place in that front office, but he's got a heavy hand in running the show in Charlotte. So, you know, the Lance Stephenson signing is, I put that one on MJ's shoulders, and how much money Kemba Walker gets is going to have a lot to do with what his heirness says and is comfortable paying him. It's going to be interesting to see the decision made there as Charlotte loses tonight to the Celtics, which really is going to hurt their playoff prospects. For the Celtics, it was kind of a must-win game in a sense. It vaults them back into the playoffs. With 9 games left, they've got tiebreakers over Indiana and Brooklyn, their most immediate threats to the 8th seed. Is this your pick? Are the Celtics your team to claim that final spot in the East?
It's funny because a couple of games ago, I would say certainly, but they sort of went on a little mini losing streak. Now they're back into it. I want to pick them. I guess I lean slightly toward them because I feel like they would probably be the most dangerous opponent for the Hawks, although let's be honest, I don't know if any team that makes the playoff is a really dangerous opponent for the Hawks, unless Paul George manages to come back for Indiana and make that interesting, or Miami happens to slip to the eighth.
Yeah, that is another interesting scenario. Hopefully, the Celtics can get this done and we can continue having the Celtics post-game show right here in the playoffs. Now, if you want to get your opinions heard on tonight's show, 347-215-771 is the number. Again, that's 347-215-7771. Calvin Chamberlain, Bobby Krivitsky, we've got Matt Rury on social media. Feel free to hit us up, CLNS Radio. Bringing it to you. Now, Calvin, it's interesting you talk about the Celtics potentially giving the Hawks the most difficult series out of, the teams in contention for that eighth spot. What I see from the Celtics is a team who has a lot of principles and philosophies in common with Atlanta, certainly not the talent or the execution level, but a lot of what Atlanta does are stuff that Boston is trying to do and working to establish right now at this stage in the rebuilding process. So I think it would be great for the Celtics to experience firsthand, not just what it takes mentally and physically to prepare yourself to elevate your play to an even higher level by getting into the playoffs, but also furthermore, by having the opportunity to get into the playoffs and play a team that you're trying to emulate.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, they don't have Atlanta's personnel. I mean, obviously they replicate each other in some ways. They both like to spread the floor. Paul Millsap is sort of like, an on-steroids version of Brandon Bass. He's an undersized power forward who he does everything better than Bass does, but he's similar body type, a similar type of player. It would help a lot if the Celtics had an Al Horford defending the post, but unfortunately they have Tyler Zeller defending the post. But you're right; they have a lot of smaller guards that they play at the same time. I guess it would also help if the Celtics had a Kyle Korver. But now this comparison is just making me sad now. But I think playoff experience is ultimately a good thing for the guys on this team, and a lot of people poo-poo that and say, "Oh, it'd be better if the Celtics won the lottery." But what the difference? Again, the difference between I don't have the actual number in front of me, but the potential 11 pick versus the 14th or 15th pick, let's see, 13 lottery teams. So what are we talking about? 17th pick, Do I think that or 16th pick rather? Do I think that the 16th pick is really that much different than the 11th pick or the 12th pick? Not really. In the lottery, what your chances of jumping up at that point are minuscule, and so maybe you're somebody who doesn't want to watch playoff basketball in favor of a minuscule chance in getting a top three pick. But I feel like that mindset is it's not. It's not what I would want out of a fan base or out of an organization at that point. Would I rather be a top three team than make the playoffs in the East as an eight seed and get swept? Yeah, maybe. That's fair. But I think at a certain point, the value of just getting a couple of picks higher becomes negligible as opposed to giving a treat to your fans and giving them, even though they don't really have a chance. The illusion of a chance is just good enough on its own, and even winning one playoff series or even a couple of games against Atlanta will be, in my opinion, will feel better than just being a high lottery team and ending up with the 11th pick in the draft. What is that going to get you in terms of going into next season?
Exactly, and I also think that what's happened here in Boston is that when the big three were here and they were competing for championships, and even when the big three was here and they really weren't competing for championships, it was easy for fans to talk down at the time on a team like the Hawks, ironically enough, and say, well, what is it worth to be in the middle class of the NBA or to get into the back half of the playoffs just to lose in the first round? What does that accomplish in the quest for a championship? And it was easy to say that at the time because the Celtics weren't in that situation. Now the shoe is on the other foot, and the Celtics are rebuilding, and they're at a point in their process in terms of trying to build a contender that there's it's immensely valuable for this team to get into the playoffs and to learn all the lessons that come with that, to play a team that you're trying to emulate. And there's a lot of good that can come out of the playoffs. So now, all of a sudden, what you have is a group of fans and an entire fan base that are clinging to these games here late in the season, hoping and watching the Celtics saying, you know what, I wanted you to tank, but since that's out the window, now let's see you get in the 8 seed. Now I want to see you get that last playoff spot.
And I'm still here, right? I just heard a weird clicking noise.
Yep, you're good. You're good.
Okay. And by the way, for those people who are saying that about how terrible it is, you know, to be in the middle, well, think back to last year, 2014. Where were Atlanta and Golden State last year? They were in the middle of the pack. Guess where they're at now? They're on top of the East and the West, respectively. You don't think that experience, like, helped them with that? You don't think that you can go from the middle to the top? There is a thing called growth. You know, like, the idea that you can't get better is ludicrous. Like, that's how teams get better. You don't go from terrible to the best team in the league unless you somehow, you know, trade for a superstar, like in a Miami or a Boston situation that rarely happens in practical terms. You get better by, you know, your guys getting better and you getting experience and you learning how to play with guys and you becoming a better team. If this was Golden State's first rodeo in the playoffs now as a one seed, I wouldn't be too excited about their opportunity to win the title. But because they went through what they've gone through the last couple of years, they look a lot better to me.
You are dead on. And I mean, talk about going, you know, talk about it being a process. Just look at Atlanta. Last year, they were the 8th seed. This year, number one team in the Eastern Conference. Why? Because last year in the process was their first year under Mike Budenholzer. They were just learning his principles. Now everyone affectionately refers to them as Spurs East, and they've got that system down. Even Steve Kerr said, and remember, Golden State has the number one offense in the league, or number two offense in terms of offensive rating. Even Steve Kerr said that they are significantly behind Atlanta in terms of offensive execution. So all you got to look at is where your team is at in the process. And for Atlanta, for Golden State, last year, in terms of, you know, legit, in terms of being an immediate title contender, no, they weren't really. But in terms of building a team and getting where they are now, it was inestimable.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the kind of experience that the Celtics can draw on, you know, as they become better. I mean, obviously, they're missing some pieces in the ceiling on this team. I don't think is significantly higher than this specific team, is what I'm saying, significantly higher than the way they're playing right now. But that doesn't mean, you know, when they add that piece or you know, when Danny Ainge makes the moves that he makes, the guys who are here, you know, won't draw upon that time that they spent together playing the Hawks and, you know, even playing the same team in the playoffs, you know. A team like the Hawks, it looks like they're going to be around for a couple of years. So maybe you play them and you get destroyed, but you see what they do in the playoffs. You see, you know, you see their sets. You play them five or six games, and you realize, you say, okay, well, this is what we can do effectively against this team. They did this to us, and then in the off season, you go out and you try to find somebody who can guard Horford if he goes off against you or whatever it is. But you use that information to, you know, affect how you build your team and how you think going forward.
Now, in that quest for growth, this offseason, would you prefer the Celtics be patient, re-sign some of their own guys, and focus on the draft? Or is there a realistic free agent target out there that you'd like the Celtics to go out and sign?
Well, I'm definitely of the belief that the teams that do have money in this offseason should make some sort of attempt to spend it before the cap rises, and more specifically, before every team in the league has significant cap money, especially a team like Boston, because, you know, you can argue. I've heard Celtics fans a million times tell me, oh, we've never got a significant free agent to come to Boston. We always have to do it via trade. Well, if that's your mindset, and I understand that, you know, you could say that it might not be the most appealing place, although I don't completely understand that, to sign a free agent. With that in mind, you know, if you're one of the, I don't have the exact, you know, number in front of me, but if you're one of the 10 teams that has free agency money, significant money in this offseason, why wouldn't you try to spend it now as opposed to in you know, next year's offseason when you're going to be one of 30? So, you know, even if you have to overpay a guy a little bit, again, with the way this cap situation is going to work out, that'll all work out okay in the end anyway. So, if I'm the Celtics, yeah, I'd start making a run in the offseason at, you know, anybody. I'd make that run at Kevin Love, obviously. I don't know how you feel about him at this point, but I certainly still think that he's max worthy. They just don't use him right. I'd make a run at Draymond. I'd make a run at anybody you think can help your team next year.
I certainly think that Kevin Love, last year's and potentially this offseason's white whale for the Celtics, what is interesting to me is he's certainly worth max money in my eyes, and this is more a question of just not being a good fit with Cleveland. If you're Kevin Love, Calvin, do you opt in? Do you give this chance with the Cavs a full offseason, and you say, I've seen what LeBron has done with Wade and with Bosch, what he's been able to get out of Kyrie now, and I want to give us another opportunity to make it work, and then I'll cash in with the salary cap set to increase dramatically? Or do you say, you know what, I know we're winning here, things are looking good, but this is just not the right fit for me, and I don't need to see anymore. I'm out. I want to go back to being the guy. I can do it on a team like Boston, for example, that's committed to winning, and I can be on a max contract there and be featured more prominently. Which way would you lean if you're Kevin Love?
I think a huge part of that depends on how well the Cavaliers do. I think if they get in the finals, and not even how well the Cavaliers do, but how well Kevin Love does in the playoffs as well. Because if obviously there's going to be a time in which the Cavaliers struggle under the offense that they're working currently, and they have to try something different and figure something out, that thing is going to be, you know, focusing on Kevin Love in a way that they haven't done so far, because he's not an ideal player to put with LeBron. I think there'll be times when Kevin Love has that opportunity. Now, if he does that and, you know, the Cavs are a success, they win a title, or if they get to the finals and, you know, they don't get blown out in the finals, then I think it's going to be difficult for him not to at least give it one more year. But I think in any other situation, should they lose in the ECF or should they get destroyed in the finals, I think that if you're Kevin Love, it's hard to make the argument that you can go back into Cleveland next year without any changes, with the same head coach, with them running the same system that sort of neutralizes your game, and then expect a max contract under the new system when you have 2 years of underperforming numbers under your belt. You say Kevin Love, you know, has another year next year, just like this year, where he's putting up like 17-9 or whatever he's averaging right now. It's not that great. He's going to have a hard time getting up that max contract from another team at that point. I think that in the prime of his career, it's hard to make the argument that you want to, you know, just subvert your game like that for that long a period and then go somewhere else and get a max deal.
That is interesting. And, you know, maybe you have a more creative solution, but for me, as far as him being in Cleveland, what I think at least is, makes the most sense is, when LeBron is at the small forward position, for him obviously to be at the four, but then we all know that the Cavs are at their best when James, like in Miami, is playing that power forward position and they can go smaller. So to me, it's Kevin Love playing alongside of LeBron and Kyrie when James is at the three, but as soon as James moves up to that four spot, what makes the most sense is for Kevin Love to anchor the second unit and be the focal point of that offense, which he can do, given not just his shooting, but his passing as well.
I think that's an interesting thought, but I think that politically it'll be far too difficult to move Kevin Love to the bench. I think at that point you're essentially telling him that he's not valuable. And you know, no one's, if you're Kevin Love, you're going to go from being the man on Minnesota, considered one of the 10 best players in the league, to coming off the bench, I don't see politically how they'd be able to pull that off, and that, you know, the media would be all over it, just as they're already all over this love LeBron situation now, you know, questioning everything they do. So I think in practical terms, you're making a good point. I just don't think that they'd be able to pull that off politically. But
well, still starting, but playing what I would refer to as six-man type minutes. And what's interesting is, like you said, how that impacts his dollars, how that's going to affect his cash flow. Because let's say that he opts in for another year with Cleveland, and that's the best they can work out with him, then it's hard to justify paying him max money.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Would you, if that's what you're doing with Kevin Love, having him anchor the second unit, do you even want him back at that sort of contract? Now, you're going to have to offer him some sort of deal, just because, one, they traded Andrew Wiggins for him, and two, they're going to be capped out anyway. So, you know, the idea of being the same team with Kevin Love or without Kevin Love, that you can't really argue they'd be better without Kevin Love. So I think they're going to have to make him an offer one way or another, but it's sort of them being pushed into a deal they probably, if they had their druthers, you know, wouldn't want to do. But I think go ahead, I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt you there. There was a brief pause. Thought they meant you were wrapped up, but you're more than welcome to finish your point, Calvin. That's my apologies.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think the other problem is that LeBron, you know, he plays 37 minutes a game. I just looked it up. And you know, so for Kevin Love to also get significant minutes, they're going to have to find a way to have him play with LeBron. I mean, the way he plays with LeBron right now is essentially as the spot-up shooting stretch four. I think it's interesting to me because I think if it was just LeBron and Love, then Love would you know, probably get a lot more opportunities to run his offense. But the problem is there's only so much ball handling that can go around. And with Kyrie Irving out there, obviously a guard, and LeBron playing that power position, the only other, you want the rim protector, but then you need the other two guys to be shooters. If Kevin Love was more of a rim protector or an alley-oop guy, like a Tyson Chandler type of guy, then they could probably get him plenty of points. But instead, it's like, they don't really have the opportunity to work into their offense what Kevin Love is good at.
And it's unfortunate because I know people, it's easy to say if he was a rim protector, if he had the size to play center, that this would work beautifully. But even if he wasn't a rim protector, if he was more mobile, for example, Chris Bosh was great at defending and still is great, you know, when he's healthy, obviously, at defending the pick and roll. If Kevin Love could do that, I don't want to say as good just because of how much Chris Bosh excels in that area, but if he was, you know, if that was a strong suit in his game, then you would really have a big three that meshes perfectly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree. And Bosh obviously had to subvert his game as well. He just seemed more willing to do it. You know, he was a more below post guy, not as much, you know, not the low post beast that Kevin Love is, but certainly was more of a low post guy in Toronto, and he just, you know, pushed himself further and further away from the basket to open up space. And Kevin Love, yeah, he is a great 3-point shooter for his size anyway, but that's really not utilizing him to the best of his abilities.
You are listening to the Celtics post game show right here on CLNS Radio. The number to call is 347-215-7771. Again, make your opinions heard by dialing 347-215-7771. Taking a break from the NBA to look at the NCAA tournament right now as March Madness gets closer to the end. Calvin, how's your Final Four looking? And secondly, how do you see these games, Michigan State, Duke, Kentucky, Wisconsin? How do you see these two heavyweight matchups playing out?
Well, I got Kentucky and Wisconsin, like, you know, the majority of America, so I'm not patting myself on the back too hard, but the other two I did not have. I feel like it's sort of a cop-out to pick three number ones, right? Like, I'll never pick more than two number ones. I just feel like, while maybe logical, it's also just, I don't know, it's a
coward's
way out.
You just can't be that person.
Yeah, it's just, it's just no balls. I'm just going to come out and say it, no balls.
Exactly. I had... You know, maybe you should pat yourself on the back. I got Duke right, but I had Arizona not just getting into the Final Four, Calvin, they were my pick to win it all. I looked at Hyundai Jefferson. I looked at Stanley Johnson. I looked at McConnell. I thought this team with Brandon Ashley back, I thought this team had a legitimate opportunity to knock off Kentucky. They couldn't even get past Wisconsin, so I'm a little disappointed.
So let me ask you this. Do you think Wisconsin can knock off Kentucky? I mean, I'm not really a believer in Duke. I have no idea why. You know what it is? I'll be honest with you. It was because I said this on our own show. I'm a little bit skeptical of Okafor's potential at the next level, and I feel like if he goes up against a guy like Towns, I just feel like he's going to get dominated in that matchup.
And looking at that matchup, I think it helps validate why you and I'm in the same boat would take Towns over Okafor. To me, he's obviously the better player defensively. I think he's more athletic. He's bigger. And we've seen what he's been able to do offensively. I know against Notre Dame, there was a lot of one-on-one opportunities right near the basket, but his offensive game has come a long way for an 18-year-old in just one season of college basketball. I definitely, if I had the number one pick, would take Towns over Okafor.
I don't mean to say that he's a bust, but I think that I would take Russell over Okafor as well at this point. And I watch him, and granted, he's big and he's extremely polished. I just don't know if some of the hook shots that he takes or some of the low post position that he's getting in a lot of these scenarios, I'm just not sure he's going to be able to get that in the NBA, particularly today's NBA.
Exactly. And I think one thing he does have going for him is he's a cerebral player. I think he's very smart, especially when it comes to handling himself in double teams. So that will help him adjust to how NBA defenses scheme for him. Now, going back to your original question about do I think Wisconsin can beat Kentucky, I thought Notre Dame going into the game could have beaten Kentucky, especially with their ability to get hot from beyond the arc. Obviously, that almost happened, but didn't. Looking at Wisconsin, Calvin, one thing that bodes well for them in this matchup is that they do have size. They're a pretty big team across the board, and their big guys, most notably Kaminsky and Sam Decker, can step back beyond the arc and hit threes and stretch Kentucky's defense out.
Yeah, I think that's their only shot, right? The big guys have got to hit their perimeter shots because, as much as I'm there's no bigger Kaminsky fan than me, but I have a hard time thinking that he's going to, do a lot of posting up on or even dribble drives to the rim on Towns and Colley Stein and get into the rim, but he certainly can pull those guys out, and exactly like you said, and hit those perimeter jump shots. That's what it's going to take to beat a team like Kentucky is heat from the perimeter. And like you said, Notre Dame almost pulled it up.
Looking at Kaminsky, you're a huge fan, so it's only right that I ask you, how do you think his game translates to the NBA level?
You know what? Better than it did a couple of years ago, right? I mean, with the direction that the NBA is moving, could Frank Kaminsky, why can't Frank Kaminsky be Kelly Olynyk? I'm not saying he could be a star, but why can't he be Olynyk? He could be Kelly Olynyk.
And I think that's a terrific comparison right there. Neither one is overly athletic, but they bring size and offensive versatility. I like that comparison.
Yeah, Olynyk's a good perimeter shooter. Kaminsky can get, when you're that big, you can get that three off on anyone. And Olynyk's shown that he can do it time and again. And I think he's got that, much like Olynyk has a sort of a sneaky post game where he kind of just sneaks in behind the play and gets a lot of, easy garbage buckets that you wouldn't expect a guy who's not the strongest guy in the world to get. And I think Kaminsky kind of has that too, where he just kind of slinks in there when you don't expect it.
Right, he has that craftiness to his game. We're going to take our first call of the night. And if you want to call in and make your opinions heard, the number to do so at is 347-215. Up, they have just dropped the line. Never mind that one, Calvin. I thought we were going to hear from a third party, but they have hung up and chickened out right as they were about to get called. It's all good. If you want your opinions to be heard and will stay on long enough for me to hit the talk button, it's 347-215-7771. Again, that's 347-215-7771. So, Calvin, now I ask you to continue our March Madness discussion. Who is your national champion?
It's Kentucky. Yeah, in the end, it's going to be Kentucky.
And would you rather see, for you personally, is it more exciting for Kentucky to accomplish the history of a perfect season, or would you get more of a thrill out of seeing them lose and seeing one of those underdogs upset them?
I would rather see, I'm somebody who, like, yeah, I enjoy heartbreak, I guess, like, except obviously when it comes to my team, but I enjoy heartbreak, so I'd like to see, yeah, maybe I'd like to see Kentucky get to the final and, you know, lose to Michigan State. I mean, that'd be fun, right?
You want it out there on the biggest stage possible.
Yeah, I mean, I would like, well, here's the thing, I don't really want Duke to win the title either. So I suppose that I would want Wisconsin and Michigan State to win it. Michigan State would be ideal just because, yeah, the heartbreak involved, and there's a lot of rumors about Calipari jumping to the NBA, and I think that'd be quite a note to jump out on.
That would be interesting. Do you think winning a title makes it more or less likely that he leaves Kentucky?
I honestly don't think that John Calipari feels like he has anything to prove, because, well, the thing about Kentucky and, you know, everywhere he's been, but particularly Kentucky, is that it's a recruiting machine. And I think that win or lose, if he wanted to go back, he'd probably be a title favorite in a year or two regardless, right? But, you know, Kentucky kind of takes care of itself. And not to discredit his coaching, because I do think that he's underrated as an X and O's coach, but it's really more the fact that, like, he's created a powerhouse, not created, but sort of, you know, built back up a powerhouse that can run itself. So if he's interested in leaving, he's going to leave regardless of whether he wins that title.
Yeah, that's a sound point, and I do agree. I think that Kentucky is a type of program that, now that they're back in the spotlight and have returned to prominence, that as long as their next coach is another solid hire, that they can continue to get big-time recruits, even if it's at a lesser rate than when Calipari was there. What's interesting, and I know everyone looks at this year as being almost like a now or never type situation for Calipari to go back to the NBA if he has any plans of doing so. But I could understand, or at least see a scenario playing out where Cleveland, partially because of David Blatt's contract, give him another year, give him a second chance, obviously depending on how the playoffs go. And then after next season, again, provided they don't win the championship, moving on from Blatt and bringing in Calipari to coach LeBron, because I don't know where you stand on this. You might be less convinced than I am, but I just have a hard time believing that LeBron James would ever leave Cleveland again.
No, I don't think he can leave Cleveland again just for the political fallout that he's set himself up for. So I don't think he's going to, and I don't think he will. I think that Blatt, you know, barring a playoff disaster, is going to have to need another year. I think it's going to be difficult to blow him out and bring in Calipari. Although that'd be interesting. I do think that he'll join the NBA in this offseason, but I also think that he doesn't have to. I don't agree with the notion that you know, it's now or never for him.
And neither do I.
Why couldn't it be after next season? Why couldn't, I mean, obviously this would never happen, but why couldn't he, you know, why couldn't he coach, for example, the Spurs after Popovich retired? Why couldn't that happen?
Wow, you just blew my mind a little bit with that one. Could you imagine just what a shift it is in styles and personalities to go from Greg Popovich to John Calipari? That's almost the team that I want to see him go to the most now.
Hasn't Popovich claimed that he's retiring when Tim Duncan retired?
I'm
skeptical on that, because I think Duncan might retire after this season, and I can't see Popovich going right now, but it would be interesting if that happened.
It would be. I don't know if they're going to go out together or not, but it feels like that would just be such a shock to the system for San Antonio. In one sense, it's an opportunity to rebuild in earnest and to really get a fresh take on things. You know, bring in a new guy with a chance to run his system while keeping some of San Antonio's principles under Popovich. But on the other hand, to lose both at the same time is just, it's such a gut punch to the Spurs.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's why he won't actually do it. And, you know, he's saying that maybe because he doesn't want to be bad again. But I think that, you know, with what they're getting out of Kawhi right now and with Duncan retiring, they free up some money and they still have their system in place. Maybe Popovich will go with those guys, but I don't know. I right now, it's like when guys say certain things about when they're going to retire, I always take it with a grain of salt, because especially if they try to advance it, you know. If you say I'm going to retire at the end of this season, I'll believe you. But when a guy says I'm going to play 3 more years and then retire, I always say, you know, I'll see you in 3 years. We'll see how you feel. The same thing with coaches. You tell me you're going to retire when Duncan retires, I'll believe it when I see it.
Now, I agree with you there, but being a Lakers fan, I got to ask you, what do you see as a timeline for Kobe Bryant? When do you think that he actually calls it quits?
I think it depends entirely on how much he's recovered in next season, when it comes to next season, and more importantly, how much he has left physically. I think that if he's even what he was at the start of last season, I think that he could potentially play another season or two. Now, the Lakers won't want to pay him, and that becomes another thing of you know, is he willing to sacrifice his money at that point and be a sort of role player on a team going forward? That'd be interesting. I seriously doubt that they'd give him another contract of significance. I mean, you know, maybe they'd pay him $8 to $10 million, but I can't see much more than that. So I kind of lean towards him retiring for that reason, just because of the political. I don't think he'd play for another team at this point, and sort of the political difficulties of him maybe still wanting more than the Lakers would be willing to pay him. I don't think his pride would allow him to settle for less in that scenario. So I lean in that direction, but I think that he certainly could come back if he's healthy enough after this next season.
How much do you think the team's competitiveness factors into Bryant's decision? For example, let's say that the Lakers aren't able to woo anyone this offseason, but they convince Kobe that they've got some things lined, you know, that at the end of next season, after a year similar to this one, that they convince Kobe they've got some things lined up, especially with the increase in cap space and all the flexibility that this team has financially, that they've got a team that can immediately step in and compete for a championship. Do you think that tempts Kobe into, after going through a season of mediocrity, coming back?
I think if Kobe has to go through another season of mediocrity by himself with no help, I have a hard time thinking at that point, 38-year-old Kobe Bryant would be so easily swayed about the potential. It would have to be, you know, Kobe being a free agent, okay, let's see who the Lakers sign and then I'll make my decision. Or, you know, obviously he would be involved in the recruiting pitch process. But I think that I don't think that he would commit to coming back until he saw what the potential team could be. And that potential team would have to be something impressive.
Now, Bryant's not the only one whose clock is ticking, at least theoretically. Jim Buss has said if he doesn't turn this team around, I believe that next year is the last chance. I believe he said 3 years, that he's going to step down. Are you buying that, or do you think there's no way he actually goes through with that?
I think that there's no way he actually goes through with that. Now, there'll be I've heard, you know, Jeannie and Jim don't get along entirely well, so I think that she might have something to say about that in terms of maybe moving him to or giving him a different title or basically giving herself the title that he holds now. I could kind of see that, but I think ultimately what'll happen is they'll it'll just be a lot of words about it, how it's a process, and they're moving in the direction they expected to move in.
Can I tell you, that is one of the most fascinating future storylines for me, is to see how this plays out. Of course, the Lakers are the Lakers. They could get good in the blink of an eye and land one, if not more, big-name free agents this offseason. All of a sudden, they're in business again. But if they don't, man, is it going to be exciting to see how that plays out, and if Jim Buss holds true to his word and actually removes himself from that position.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because people will definitely bring it up. And, you know, like you said, the clock is ticking at it. It'll be fun to see what they do in this offseason. What I'm worried about is that gives them the impetus to go after guys that I don't want them to go after, particularly Rajon Rondo.
As a fan, are you confident in Jim Buss, or would you rather see him step down and put someone else in power?
Well, it's interesting because Laker fans are particularly brutal on Jim Buss, where I've sort of taken a more passive stance. I don't think that his body of work has been large enough to really fully criticize him. The Steve Nash trade was a disaster, but it wasn't his decision. It was actually a Jerry Buss decision. And at the time, considering where the Lakers were drafting, and considering the value of draft picks at the time, it wasn't a terrible trade. It just didn't work out. The Dwight Howard trade was a good trade that again didn't work out because, you know, Dwight Howard was one of the only free agents in NBA history willing to just leave that fifth year on the table. I didn't expect that to happen. I expected it at the worst a sign and trade, and you can blame Jim Buss for that, but really, if you want to assign blame, you'd have to assign it, you know, with Mike D'Antoni and secondarily to Kobe, or assign the blame to Howard himself for his demeanor. But I think that, you know, Buss's impact on that is relatively small. So beyond that, the only terrible move that the Lakers have done is sign Kobe to the deal that they signed him to. Everything else is just an absence of moves they tried to make that, you know, they couldn't lure free agents. So do I blame Buss for that? Not necessarily, no. I think I blame Buss for the Kobe contract, but I also understand the political process behind that and how, you know, they wanted to appease him. It was right after, you know, Jerry Buss died. And it's certainly unfortunate, but it's not, to me, a systematic pattern of incompetence like many people have suggested.
Yeah, and that's why I think suggesting such a short span to try and turn the team around, I can understand it. It's the Lakers, and you have a fan base that, similar to the Celtics, has a tendency to get impatient. I can understand where he was coming from, but it just doesn't really make sense to put such a small window in place. And moving on, as we come back to this current season, looking at things, if the Golden State Warriors, and I know the Rockets have just passed the Grizzlies in the standings, they have one less loss currently. But if the Warriors and the Grizzlies, which for the most part has been the top two teams in the West, if they meet up in the Western Conference Finals, do you think that size, I know that they have Draymond Green, obviously Golden State, but just do you think that's the type of team, that old school style of basketball with two traditional big men like Gasol and Randolph, do you think that is the style, the formula that overcomes the more aesthetically pleasing Warriors?
Well, it's funny because you mentioned Draymond, but Memphis is the one team in the West that has two guys that Draymond can't really guard. Zach Randolph is just too strong for Draymond in the post. Marc Gasol is too big for him out on the perimeter, or, you know, sort of at the elbow. And I feel like that he has some tough time guarding guys in that situation. Obviously, Bogut's health will matter in how many minutes he can play, but that second guy is Memphis's opportunity to go off. So I do think that that's a tougher matchup than a lot of the other teams in the West for a team like Golden State. Like, you know, those are the two teams, along with San Antonio, I guess, at this point, right, that you would say have a real legitimate chance to come out of the West. Portland would have been interesting, you know, had Wes Matthews not gotten hurt. So I think the fact that Golden State spreads that spread style, or runs that spread style rather, that, you know, San Antonio also runs, but Golden State is better at, I would think that Golden State would win that matchup, not handily, but fairly, because they sort of do the same things, whereas Memphis, I do think, poses problems for them.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting because Memphis also has Tony Allen, who can go back and forth guarding Curry and Thompson. Mike Conley is a very good defensive point guard, one of the more underrated floor generals in the league. And then you also have Jeff Green, who, for as much of an enigma as he is, and I know he hasn't, you know, lived up to some of the expectations they thought that he would achieve in Memphis, where significantly less of the burden is on his shoulders, but still, his three-point percentage has risen about 7%, I believe, off the top of my head. It's gone from 30 to 37% now. So if he gets going in the playoffs and maybe even provides some transition baskets for them off of stops, it's going to be interesting to see if those two teams match up, and just in general how far Memphis can go with more of a traditional style of play.
Well, the other guy who can hit the three, the other former Celtic, Courtney Lee, he's been playing really well for them this season. In fact, you know, it was Jeff Green who went to the bench and not Lee when Tony Allen made his way back into the starting lineup. I thought that was interesting.
And you talked about Portland, who it is a shame that Matthews went down. He's in a contract year, and I also thought they had a legitimate chance to at least get to the Western Conference Finals, if not perhaps. What?
Can I ask you about something in regards to that? Because I also brought this up the other day. When we're talking about the Celtics and whether or not they should spend money in this offseason, now, Wesley Matthews, you know, tore his Achilles. He's going to be out, you know, for probably the first couple of months of the new season. If you're a team like the Celtics, would you, he's a guy who would have gotten a max offer. What kind of money would you offer Wes Matthews, or would you even consider trying to get this guy at what could be a bargain rate, considering the injury he's coming off of? Or do you think the risk is just too great for him at this point?
And here's the thing, that's an interesting question. The reason I would not sign Wes Matthews if I'm the Celtics is because you have Avery Bradley, and this is just a personal belief. I like the notion of having at least one of your two perimeter wings being someone who's an all-around scorer. Matthews is a terrific three-point shooter. Obviously, he's a very good defender. Sometimes that does get overstated, but certainly very effective on that side of the floor. But if you already have Avery Bradley, I wouldn't want two 3-and-D wings. I would rather have my other perimeter wing be a player who can put the ball on the floor and get to the basket.
Is Avery a 3-and-D wing, or is he sort of an 18-and-D wing? I mean, he's not really that much of a three-point shooter, compared to Wes Matthews, certainly not.
No, certainly not compared to Matthews, but you're still stuck with the two of them. And Bradley, I know he came up, you know, knocking down threes from the corners, which he doesn't get as many looks from anymore, but he also has proven capable of making shots from above the break.
Yeah, I just don't think he takes very many of them. And Wes Matthews is a guy who goes up for that three every time. So he's shooting 35% from three, about league average. Matthews is one of the best three-point shooters in the league. I'm not saying I do see the redundancy in there, especially with Smart in there playing a lot of that small forward. Although, you know, in that scenario, you obviously let Evan Turner walk, which they'll probably do anyway. So, in that scenario, maybe you want to continue, you know, keeping Isaiah Thomas on the bench. And I just think there's a way, you know, potentially getting this guy, if he comes back to being anything that he was previously, and I don't think he's just a three-point shooter. I think he's got a pretty good dribble drive game as well. I'm a huge fan of his, and I think that if he comes back to anything near what he was, somebody's going to get him at a steal. And, you know, I'd like for it to be a team like the Celtics, or I guess the Lakers.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good chance that someone gets him on a team-friendly contract. Perhaps he re-ups with Portland. And it will be interesting to see how he recovers from the injury. I can't just emphatically state, as if I'm from the future, that he's going to come back and be fine. But quite frankly, I'm not all that concerned about how he's going to respond to the injury, especially if, you know, he's, if the mental aspect that comes with being sidelined isn't a factor for him or isn't a significant factor, he gets over it quickly. So he's not a player who I'm overly concerned with recovering from injury, but Kevin Durant is. And I'm curious, you know, if you're Oklahoma City, what's up?
That's interesting. Go on, finish your point, and I'll, go ahead.
Well, I'm just, you know, if you're Oklahoma City, you've got this history with the injury where, first off, most people who have it, they recover after the first surgery, and it's not really an issue again. He's one of the few people, it's less than 5%, that continue to be affected by it, has another surgery, obviously, we know the deal. You know, it's hard to throw max money at a player like that. I know that Steph Curry had ankle problems, and they paid him, and it's worked out beautifully for them so far. Knock on wood, hope that continues. With Durant, though, you're going to have one season to really evaluate how he's recovered. Is that enough?
I think that Kevin Durant, I think that Kevin Durant sort of takes on a bad rap in terms of injuries because he's slight of frame. Whereas, you know, Westbrook has gotten just as many injuries in the last couple of years as Durant. He just comes back, you know, superhuman, and everyone sees him as being this physical force. But he's also gotten hurt a fair amount. Kevin Durant has had a career. If you just look at his, you know, his career pattern, he doesn't really get hurt very much at all, even though you would think with his frame that he would. I'm not concerned about him, especially because, you know, even if he is not athletically what he was, he's still such a good shooter and such, you know, he's actually an underrated defender, in my opinion, that I wouldn't hesitate for a second to sign Kevin Durant. And I think because his injury is a foot injury, as opposed to, and that's why I was questioning your statement, because Matthews' injury is an Achilles injury, which I think that, you know, it's a lot more difficult to come back from that than Kevin Durant's injury, which I think has been aggravated by the fact that he keeps coming back, you know, before he's ready repeatedly, and it's wear and tear. And basically, the only reason why he's not playing is because he needs rest, not because his foot is significantly unsound. I think that they've just realized that the only way to heal it at this point is for him to lay off it. So I wouldn't expect that to be a problem going into next season. I think the bigger issue is whether or not the Thunder have to trade Durant before he goes into his free agency, because I think Kevin Durant in a million years will never say, trade me or I'll leave. But I think if you have inside knowledge as to his mindset, it might be difficult for OKC to retain this guy, and if they're going to trade him, you're going to get the most value for him in the offseason.
Yeah, and I think that certainly not the overriding factor, but something that I would expect came up in the discussion amongst the brass in Oklahoma City is that this is an opportunity for us to do right by Kevin Durant, to not try and be on the side of, you know, asking him or forcing him or wanting him to rush back again from injury and, you know, come back in time for the playoffs. This is a chance for us to show Kevin, we have your best interests at heart. And that's huge for them. It's also important for Oklahoma City to remember, I know that Presti has a terrific track record in the draft, but you're not exactly a hotbed for free agents. So you get a homegrown superstar, the likes of Kevin Durant, when healthy, the second best player in the game. For now, we'll see where Anthony Davis is at even next year. But for now, second best player in the game, when on the court, KD. And so it's really, you know, it's one of those things where there's a lot of factors pushing you towards, we can't afford to lose this player. Not to mention, when he's on the court, there's no questions, there's no debating his game and what he's capable of.
Right. I just think, obviously, if you're a team like Oklahoma City, you really have to question, you know, with his impending free agency, if he is going to be willing to stay after that in OKC. And I think you try to give him an extension in this offseason, and if he refuses and he just wants to play out the season, and say, you know, we'll go from there, I really think that they do have to take a legitimate look out and see what they could get for him out there, because if you're the Thunder, you're not going to be able to get free agents, especially after next season when, you know, every team in the NBA has that money out of the cap. Westbrook will be a free agent the following season, so they have to worry about that as well. I think that they legitimately do have to take a look, and, you know, provided he won't sign that extension now in this, or not now, but after this season, and see what they could get for him.
And we know that Durant will want to get to free agency, but like you've continued to bring up, if you're a team, you know, from a front office standpoint, you can't risk losing him for nothing. So he's going to want to play out next year, presumably. Oklahoma City is going to want some sort of indication of where he's at. If you're Durant, though, and you, assuming the Thunder don't win the championship this season without him, and then you look at the fact that it's almost a guarantee, barring injuries, that they're going to be competitive. They're going to be a legitimate championship contender next season. Again, this is providing good health and him being a part of that. You look at the situation and say, I know what I have in Oklahoma City. I want to stay here. Plus, he's also heavily involved in the community. Or is there a part of you that's pushing to get to a major market, you know, a team like Brooklyn or New York or Los Angeles?
I think that that's less relevant than it was. I think that one time it wasn't an issue at all for Durant. And I still don't think, to be honest with you, I still don't think that's going to be the primary factor that ultimately drives him out of Oklahoma City. I think the bigger issue is with the cheapness of the organization, with his frustrations with the media and the small town nature of the media and how he's been portrayed there, and his frustrations with the way that Scott Brooks has been treated. I think that all those things factor. His frustrations with the medical staff, probably at this point, you'd have to imagine, with they're clearing him for games that clearly he shouldn't have been cleared for. I think all of those things, in my opinion, combine to be a bigger factor than just the notion of, yeah, I want to go play in, Washington, D.C. or L.A.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up the media aspect of it, because there's executives and general managers around the league, and even a prominent member of the Oklahoma City News, who's a beat reporter for the team, talked about how they all believe that the Thunder, because they're not as attractive a destination as a Los Angeles or Boston or any of the teams that we just mentioned, that what they do is they kind of shield their players from the media. They make it as easy as possible on them. So it's interesting. I know that Westbrook and Durant have had their blow-ups this season with the media, but it sounds like part of the perks of playing for the Thunder are that you're going to get it a little easier from the media than you are anywhere else.
Yeah, I've heard that. I think it also has to do with not so much the media being harsh on them, but just more the fact that basically in Oklahoma City, all the guys who are covering you. And if you're Kevin Durant and those guys, one Mr. Unreliable headline, and all of a sudden Kevin Durant, because he sees this guy every day, is freezing him out to a degree where I don't know if that would happen if, you're in L.A. and you're sitting in a room in front of 40, reporters. But I also think the same thing applies with Brooks. I think a lot of their hostility, his and Westbrook's, toward the media has been the way that, they've been harsh on Scott Brooks, and I don't think either of those guys like that.
Now, let me ask you, when it comes to Scott Brooks, do you think it's time for the Thunder to make a coaching change to say, Scott, we appreciate what you've done for player development and for getting us this far, but it's time to pass the torch? Or do you think they should continue to stick with Brooks?
Well, this kind of goes back to the Cleveland question you asked me about whether or not, they should put Kevin Love on the bench and have him run the second unit. Like, Oklahoma City probably should fire Scott Brooks in terms of pure logic, but with Durant and pending free agency and you attempting to re-sign him, do I think that firing Scott Brooks in this offseason would have an impact on whether or not Durant re-signed? I would have to say probably, yeah. Then you're really putting all your eggs in the basket of, I really hope Kevin Durant loves this new coach and that Oklahoma City really outstretches, you know, what they've done in the past. Otherwise, this guy's gone for sure.
Because yeah,
I'm sorry.
You can only fire Scott Brooks this offseason if you know that his replacement is someone who is going to get along with Durant and Westbrook and is going to win games and produce at the very least, and really worst case scenario, at the same level as Brooks, who has been effective, just hasn't won a championship. And, you know, who knows how that would have played out had injuries not taken place to Westbrook, Durant, and Ibaka, their big three. So you've got to know that the guy you're bringing in to replace Brooks in this scenario is someone who, at the very least, can hold serve, if not ideally take them to the next level.
Right, and there's just the risk factor of, you know, maybe you do have a Mark Jackson, Steve Kerr scenario where you bring in another coach who gets more out of the guy than previously, but what happens if that guy comes in and, you know, Russell Westbrook gets hurt and has to miss 35 games next season? Well, then that coach is not going to really have that opportunity to prove how much better he is than Brooks, and he won't have that relationship developed with Durant. So the notion of this guy's making us play so much better, maybe that would be, you know, correct in an ideal situation, it might not be applicable to how the team actually plays next year. So I think just the idea of bringing in a new coach under the, you know, the headline of you have 1 year to play better, and there's also the idea of what if Durant, you know, gives off the vibe that he might leave and that affects how the team plays. It's going to be difficult for a coach to overcome that regardless.
Well, I tell you, there's a lot going on in Oklahoma City. It's going to be interesting to see how all of this is resolved between Durant's health, which we hope is okay. You know, it's supposed to be, at least after the surgery. That's obviously the point behind having it and putting this timetable together of 4 to 6 months. We'll see what happens there, how he responds next season. Hopefully it works out similar to how Steph Curry responded to all the ankle injuries, which have now stopped, fortunately. In Houston, they're just getting a guy back from injury in Dwight Howard. They've won 7 of their last 10 games, including 4 straight. What do you see for this team in the playoffs, Calvin?
Well, I think, when it comes to Dwight, it all depends on I don't think he really fits what they do offensively, because he's always wanting to sort of get the ball in the post, and they have to dislodge themselves from what they're doing to get Dwight Howard playing. Sort of like I was saying earlier with Bradley, where his offense exists on an island separate from what the rest of the team is doing. Certainly, he helps them as a rim protector, although I guess the numbers are, they've been holding up surprisingly well without him protecting the rim. They're not way different. I think part of that has to do with Josh Smith's, defensive abilities as the big. Now, he's not a traditional big, but he's a bigger guy who can protect the rim. And I think that has a lot to do with it, but I think that he will help them as a rebounder and as a big man, and especially when games bog down in the playoffs. I think that if he's willing to do that without requiring too much offensively, then that he'll be a positive trade-off for them. But if he gets frustrated and sort of becomes lazier because he's not getting their shots, then he'll probably be a net negative for them.
Now, I think the two of us are in agreement that the injury to Wes Matthews out in Portland was a huge blow to their championship aspirations. Is the season-ending wrist injury to Patrick Beverley on the same level, or do you think Houston's in a better position to absorb that?
I don't think it is on the same level, because Patrick Beverley didn't have as large of a role as Wes Matthews. Now, Beverly, I think it'll matter, because Beverly is an agitator, particularly in a playoff series where you have to play Patrick Beverly every night, not every night, but for 7 games potentially in a series. he's going to get in your head when you have to play that guy that many times. And it would be interesting to see, you know, I saw the standings a moment ago, and they still had Houston at third because Memphis has one more win, I guess. They're tied in the loss column. But so if they were third, they'd be playing San Antonio. It'd be, I think that, you know, having Beverly hounding Tony Parker is a lot better than, you know, whatever they're going to have now. I'm not sure who's filling his place as a backup point guard off the top of my head, you know? But I know it's not going to... That's right. Yeah. So, obviously, he's not going to hound Parker the way that Beverly would. And Beverly is not a guy who puts up great stats, and he's not a huge figure in the offense other than, you know, sort of as a spot-up guy. I think you can replicate the spot-up guy aspect, but the agitator aspect, it's going to make a difference in the playoff.
Did this injury to Beverly... San Antonio, they certainly have a chance. They're only 2.5 games behind the Clippers for fifth, but it might be more palatable to stick in that sixth seed and look to play Houston, who is now sans Beverly, plus the Spurs have a difficult schedule the remainder of the season anyways. Did this just open the door for San Antonio? And not to say they wouldn't have anyways, but did this just open the door for them to come out of that matchup?
I think they could come out of that matchup anyway, like you said. But certainly it makes life a lot easier for a guy like Tony Parker. We've seen what Tony Parker can do in the playoffs. Now he's not looked great this season, but I think in recent weeks looks a lot better. And Kawhi also, after being injured the entire season, has looked a lot better. And, you know, we'll see if Kawhi can be Kawhi playing against James Harden, then really Houston has no chance in that series, right? I'd go so far as probably to make San Antonio the favorite.
Yeah, and I agree with you there. One of those teams who's in a higher seed, but because of who they are, because of who they have, they're finally getting healthy. They're finally getting hot right now. They've been one of the top teams in the league lately. You know, it looks like they are the favorites over Houston, who's now without the services of point guard Patrick Beverly. Looking at things in the East, if the Cavaliers do come out of that conference and they end up taking on whoever from the West, you know, let's say Golden State for argument's sake, can LeBron, do you like this team? Since he returned from that 2-week rest bed, this has arguably been the best team in the league, and some categories will bear that out. Might be a bit underrated in terms of championship aspirations.
Yeah, it's fascinating because you're right. They I don't know. They blow a lot of teams out, and then randomly they'll lose to a team like Miami or a team where they don't look very good at all, like a team like Brooklyn. And you're right. Record-wise, they've looked phenomenal, and some of that has to do with attrition, obviously, back-to-backs and whatnot. But I don't know. I mean, LeBron is still LeBron, so you can't ever write them off. I don't know. They're a bit of a question mark. How well what their playoff ceiling is to me is really a bit of a question mark because one, you know, Kyrie doesn't have a playoff experience, and I don't know if he's going to shoot them out of a game at some point or if he's just going to be awesome Kyrie. If he can just become Dwayne Wade, then they'll be fine. If he can't, then you know they'll have a tough time in later rounds. They're still gonna, you know, cruise past the first round or two, sure. But could they could lose to Atlanta.
Oh, and I'll tell you, I want nothing more. This has nothing to do with, you know, I'm not one of those people who just wants them to lose at everything. Nothing to do with that. But just simply by looking at the styles of play, I would love for Atlanta to come out of the East. They've been the best team in the conference all season long. And just that style of play, the fact that everyone likes to throw out that they don't have a superstar. Well, they have four all-stars who you can go down the line, and almost each one, with the exception of Korver, I'd say, who's close to a 50-40-90 season, even though he's not going to get it, but he's close to, is the only one who's not, you know, really underrated on the team. People give Horford his props, but to only such a degree. Jeff Teague, similar to Conley, just a severely underrated point guard to me. that team, that style of play, I would love it if they came out of the East.
Damari Carroll is really their underrated player. Nobody ever talks about how good that guy is.
Their X Factor.
Yeah, he sort of does it all. He's a jack of all trades, defends really well. I mean, Millsap, of course, is underrated as well. He's a guy who does everything. But, Carroll is, like, big for a small forward. To me, he does everything. I think that they would have a chance against Cleveland. I'd like to see it.
Yeah, I think they certainly have a chance. One of those things, when these two teams got together most recently and the Hawks won, you knew that part of the chess match would be neither side wanting to tip their hand too much for the playoffs should they meet up, as everyone anticipates. But at the end of that game, in the fourth quarter, what Atlanta started resorting to was when Cleveland ran pick and rolls for LeBron, they would blitz it, especially when they could do so with Millsap. And it really gave Cleveland a lot of problems, frustrated them, forced them into turnovers. And it was one of those factors that propelled Atlanta to a win. So it's going to be interesting to see how Cleveland deals with that should they meet up in the postseason.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sorry. My roommate just came up to me. Can we end this right now?
Yeah, we're done. I was pretty much going to wrap up after your answer anyways. We're all done.
Oh, okay, good. I'm sorry about that. I just have to take care of some.
Yep, no worries. That's going to...
All right.
See you later, Calvin. Everyone, appreciate you listening. Take off.
Bye.